This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Rainfall from Hurricane Matthew is still making its way downstream, and swollen rivers in eastern North Carolina continue to rise. At least 20 people have died in North Carolina as a result of the flooding. Floodwaters have closed U.S. 70 in Kinston, and traffic is being redirected near Benson along Interstate 95 and completely redirected in Robeson County. Riverline flooding is anticipated from all the big rivers in the eastern part of the state, including the Lumber, Cape Fear, Neuse, and Tar Rivers. WUNC reporter Jay Price is in Grifton, North Carolina, and joins me by phone now to tell us more. Thank you for joining us, Jay.
Hey, Frank. Thanks for having me.
I understand we sent you home to do this report. You're pretty close to home, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in my hometown, Grifton, North Carolina, which was hit pretty bad in Floyd. Really bad in Floyd. And, you know, it's like many small towns that are in the flood zone and small communities that aren't incorporated. You know, a lot of the attention goes to the medium-sized cities we have down here, Greenville, Kinston, Goldsboro, Fayetteville, you know, that have been hit really hard. But there are dozens and dozens of named and unnamed communities that are, you know, suffering in the same sorts of ways, but just don't get a lot of attention and maybe not same level of help.
So what are you seeing in Grifton?
Well, in Floyd, you have to think of this, the town is about 2,700, 2,800 people. And in Floyd, there's a creek that runs parallel to the main street in town. And that main street divides the town in two, of course. And Floyd came up all the way to the main street. Essentially, one side of the town was flooded. Water got up to town hall and so forth. Dozens and dozens and dozens of people were displaced, never came back. Right now, I'm looking at, it's like the main damage, if you're not talking about houses, is to this small commercial strip that runs 90 degrees from the main street down toward the creek. It's in near creek. The Dollar General is flooded. The Piggly Wiggly, the only grocery store in town, is underwater. The Highway 55 restaurant is underwater. I just talked to the owner of that restaurant. And there's a Mexican restaurant that was about to open, El Caminito, and it was just days away from opening. They had put new equipment in and were pretty excited about it. And, you know, in small town, rural North Carolina, if something's going on with a restaurant these days, usually means the restaurant's closing. So people were pretty excited, you know.
Yeah, that somebody's moving in, right?
Win.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so everybody's really wondering right now whether the grocery store will come back, because in these floods, and this is typical of the small towns and the large cities that get hit, it's the poor people that suffer. It's their houses that get hit because they're in the cheapest low-lying land. And these are people who might not be as likely to have an automobile, easy transport. There is no public transport down here. So the next supermarket is 7-8 miles away. And how do they get there if this place doesn't open back? So, you know, just one more kind of harsh blow that just kind of goes unnoticed in the rest of the world.
Tell us what you're seeing, because I understand just to keep things going at a minimum, you've got generators lining the streets. What does it look like?
The town hall's on a generator. Just not much electricity in downtown at all. So they're trying to keep some bandwidth going with generators and keep their electricity going so they can answer calls and keep the emergency management stuff going. Help is coming in from some of the neighboring towns. And, you know, you have to consider this is one of those places that relies on its neighbors. I mean, when I went to high school, I went to a high school that was shared with a neighboring town, Aiden Grifton High School, was shared with Aiden. Aiden's town government has sent people over to help. The next town further north from Aiden, Winterville, has sent people to help. And they're feeding people and sheltering people in Aiden, but they really want to get a shelter closer because people, the people who are displaced often don't have vehicles in these situations. They want to put a shelter closer, is what the interim town manager told me.
That's interesting. So
I'm looking at the creek right now, and it's flowing past the Piggly Wiggly. It's not just sitting static.
Yeah.
It's got the same level of current that it usually has when it's in its banks and it's moving.
So
they're not sure what's going to happen. I mean, they're like some of these other places. Greenville is waiting with bated breath now to see what the crest is going to do. But the Kentinia Creek here is going to – has come down some, but the Neuse, which is a tributary of us, is – still peaking, and they think there's a possibility it could back up, flooding worse here.
Wow. So,
and the creek giveth and the creek taketh away. The Catania Creek brought, you know, was the transport for this town early in its history, and really it's the thing that defines the town even now. Otherwise, you know, it would be just another small town in some ways. There's a festival here called the Shad Festival, been going on for almost 50 years now, and that, you know, it's given the town an identity. The shad is a fish that comes up the creek and spawn in the spring, and so they have the festival then, and they have all kinds of things, you know, beauty contests and fishing contests and a parade, and all hinged to the fish.
Yeah. Some question, you know, about whether that might even go on next year, I guess, depending on how things come back.
I asked. I mean, it's such a defining thing. They'll make it happen.
Yeah.
They'll bring it back. It's just so ironic. You sit here and look at the creek,
yeah,
and what it does for the town and what it's doing to the town right now.
Jay, thank you very much for your time, and we'll listen for your reports across the spectrum here as you continue to report on the flooding from Hurricane Matthew. Thank you, Jay Price.
Thanks, Ron.
Jay Price is a reporter for WUNC. This inland flooding brings to light some of the problems we have with storm forecasting and federal response to flooding. Joining me now is Rob Young. He's a professor of coastal geology and the director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines. He's at Western Carolina University. Welcome back, Rob.
Glad to be back.
Let's talk about the way we talk about hurricanes first, because I know this is a concern of yours when we talk about, start forecasting these hurricanes, tropical storms, and they build. Talk about storm surge and their category, and you say that to some extent we might be missing the point.
Well, I think we've relied for too long on this very simple characterization of hurricanes by their Saffir-Simpson category, you know, category 1, category 2, category 3. And, you know, those are very simple meteorological characterizations of the storm's wind speed and the central pressure of the storm, but they don't tell you anything about the amount of rain that the storm is going to drop. They don't tell you anything about the diameter of the storm or how big it is. And they don't tell you anything about how that storm's going to interact with the coastline and generate storm surge. And so we get these very simplistic presentations of potential storm impacts by the broadcast media as the storm is coming in. And we get these surprises like we have here with the tremendous amount of rain that North Carolina received during Matthew.
I want to get to another issue, too. So we should look more at the inland effects of this, the rainfall, and some of the geological factors inland that would tell us more about the kinds of things we're seeing now in the aftermath, flooding and that sort of thing. I want to move on, though, to another subject. That was a piece that you published in the New York Times, an opinion piece that the Times published. You wrote it about coastal flood insurance. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, right now the federal flood insurance program is $24 billion in debt. And we got the federal flood insurance program back in 1968 as a way to begin to try and alleviate the flood exposure and risk that communities around the U.S. were experiencing. So the idea was that if we create this federal program that requires communities to buy into the program, and those communities would have to set certain floodplain management standards in exchange for getting sort of a federal backing of flood insurance. The idea was that that would make things better. If we require that communities pay attention to the flood risk and take actions to mitigate potential flood risk, that would solve a lot of these flooding problems. And I think that what we're learning here in eastern North Carolina right now is that, you know, we're seeing flooding and property damage in the same areas that we saw from Hurricane Floyd. And that's problematic. That's the federal flood insurance program was supposed to help us find a way out of that.
Well, what do you think went wrong? How did that break down? Why didn't that change in policy result in, a better outcome?
Well, one reason the federal flood insurance program has become so mired in debt is I don't think that in 1968 policymakers ever envisioned that we would be insuring so much investment property on resort communities on the barrier islands, and you know, from New Jersey to the tip of Florida around to Texas. I think that the original vision of the program was to take care of communities like Grifton, you know, people living in their primary residence. But as a result of the expansion of federal flood insurance into the resort communities on the coast, we have sort of incentivized the development of the coastal zone across the United States of America writ large, and that's added a tremendous amount of property to the risk pool. But a lot of it is not people living in their primary residence.
So that's not what it was, not what it was designed for. I've got about 30 seconds left, but then coastal replenishment programs also feed into that to help these second properties and resort communities over and against our poorer communities.
Yeah, I think what might surprise your listeners is that you can have a coastal oceanfront community that has essentially no property damage during a hurricane, but the Federal Emergency Management Agency will actually come in and replace the beach at that community if it's an engineered beach that the community has paid for and they have a plan. So there are many instances where there have been no homes damaged or no flooding on the road, but it can still cost taxpayers billions or tens of billions of dollars because the Federal Emergency Management Agency will come in and pump that beach back up in front of the houses.
All right, Rob, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Rob Young, a professor of coastal geology and the director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines. He's at Western Carolina University. Just ahead, how to remember Dorothea Dix Hospital in Raleigh. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.